Well, I used to bring my oldest son here, but then he clerked for this court, and now he's in private practice. So,
and that's your daughter?
Yes, this is my daughter.
Yeah, I have a six-year-old. So I can identify with that.
Well, I have a two-year-old daughter, too.
Oh, wow.
Well, Dan O'Brien, the lawyer on the other side, was a law clerk for me.
I was going to ask Dan to top that Brother Hildebrand's last one.
You win. Proceed.
Okay.
Well, this court is faced with the difficult and, I would say, somewhat unpleasant task of declaring that Wisconsin's incest statute is unconstitutional as applied to consenting adults, siblings. I think that that's a necessary conclusion from the Supreme Court's opinion in Lawrence versus Texas, which talks about a liberty interest that people have as consenting adults to engage in sexual activity.
And Lawrence didn't go that far, though.
Pardon me?
Lawrence didn't go that far. Justice Scalia thought it someday it might lead to that, but it didn't.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Justice Scalia, and he said in his opinion, I think, that the sweep of the court's opinion and the rationale upon which it was based, namely a liberty interest in to engage in consensual sex, and the fact that the objections to the statute in Lawrence were based on notions of morality and all of that, that decision would simply apply to these kinds of cases.
Well, isn't an incest statute has concerns beyond morality, then?
Well, it does have some concerns beyond morality. That of course, is true, Your Honor. And those interests, of course, are the genetic interests, as well as the fact that, as occurred in this case, children can be taken away from their parents, or at least there's a discretion in that regard on the part of family courts to do that. But the case here involves sending people to jail, and that's a different matter. And I think that what Justice Scalia said, coupled with what Judge Posner wrote in his book, which I quoted in my brief, that...
That wasn't an opinion, was it?
Well, sure it was an opinion.
But not an official opinion of the court, perhaps.
No, I don't think that it was... two other judges of this court didn't sign on to that, of course.
We might have picked up a couple of votes if we had circulated it.
I was surprised that he wasn't here this morning, but anyway,
we draw the panels at random.
I know. but anyway, Your Honor, that book was quoted with great liberality in Lawrence versus Texas. And I think, with all due respect to Judge Posner, the rationale that he stated and quoted in his book is really correct, because we don't prevent people from having children because there's a genetic problem. And the other problem with the statute, of course, is that it applies to people who would have no ability whatsoever in procreating children, people of advanced age, for example. And so I think clearly under the statute is grossly overbroad and should be struck down. Now,
would you clarify one thing? Were these full brother and sister? Or
yes, Your Honor.
They were. They
yes.
have the same mother and same father.
Yes.
But didn't know it at first.
When they first, there were 14 children in this family, and it was, I think the record
I guess you
would
lose track, huh?
Yes. Well,
they were
not
separated, weren't they?
Yes. The mother had died, and these children were placed in various foster homes, and I think that the first time they realized it was after they had met and after they had found an attraction to each other. But there's no question, of course, that they knew they were siblings at the time they had children and these children were conceived. So the knowledge element of the statute was sustained.
Of course, you have these are all interesting issues, and talk about whether Lawrence versus Texas would even got that far if it was two brothers in that case. But here you have some procedural problems to get around if the Wisconsin court, the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, made a decision on the merits. You're pretty well stuck with pre-Lawrence law,
well,
unless you can fit under a very narrow exception.
I understand that, Your Honor, but all I'm asking this court to do is to take the Wisconsin Court of Appeals at its word, and it says, Muth argues the incest statute is unconstitutional, etc. While we agree with the circuit's court conclusion, we need not address it. This was a down-and-out refusal of the state court to address the constitutional issue. And in the supplemental record that was sent down from Milwaukee, we included the petition for review to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin from this issue, and Muth State Court Counsel said that the issue was, because the Court of Appeals has failed to hear the appeal, this court should enter a written decision that addresses the constitutionality of the statute. And the state, in responding to that petition, said what Muth is seeing is wanting here is a second kick of the cat at the constitutional issue. Well, the constitutional issue that was decided in Muth versus State, that's the taking the kids away case, was whether or not the state could take children away from their parents. That decision really has absolutely no bearing or no analysis on the issue of whether or not people ought to be sent to jail for this.
The Court of Appeals indicated that, in considering the constitutional challenge, indicated that that case had decided the issue, right?
Well, that's...
you say that's not a correct interpretation of their own statute.
No. What I'm saying is that what they did was they essentially took an issue preclusion analysis and said, you've already litigated this and we're not going to hear it again. And when an issue preclusion analysis is similar to refusing to decide an issue for a procedural reason, refusal to decide an issue like in Brown because the prisoner escaped during the pendency of his appeal, and some of these other cases Moore versus Park, Dye versus Frank, which we cited in our brief. Habeas corpus, of course, is based upon a respect for state courts, and that's why it's very difficult to do it. But if the state courts fail to address and decide the constitutional issue, and here it is, the constitutional issue is, can you send people to jail for this, then this is a time when the federal courts can and should adjudicate this constitutional right. To this day, Muth has not had an adjudication of whether or not the state criminal laws of Wisconsin, as applied to him, are constitutional. And it will not offend the state federal system in the courts to decide an issue which the state courts have refused and neglected to decide. And that's what habeas corpus is all about. Now, I know that it's a difficult thing to do, but I really don't think that this state court opinion from the Court of Appeals is something that tells the public and tells the litigants that criminal statutes, as applied to consenting adults, are constitutional or not. That issue was not decided, even though it was raised, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court also had an opportunity to decide it and did not take up the petition for review. Let's see, my white light is on. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you. May it please the court. When listening to Mr. Hildebrandt's argument, the one question immediately popped to mind, and perhaps the parents in this room would be better equipped to answer it, but which is worse, going to jail or losing your children?
Why is that imperative?
Because,
just a minute. Why do you think that's more important than what we have before us? Why do we have to answer that question at all?
We don't have to answer that question, I believe, because if the AEDPA standard applies, then the Wisconsin Court of Appeals acted reasonably here in concluding that the incest statute is not unconstitutional, it's not violative of due process. Mr. Hildebrandt seems to be conceding that the L&M case, which dealt with the declaration of unfit parenthood under another Wisconsin statute, based on compelling state interests in protecting not only the family harmony, but the interests of the children, genetic defects, things like that.
Well, you know, hold on a minute. You know, there's some historical background that you have to ignore when you start talking about genetic defects, leaving the Bible out, which obviously underpins the whole idea, because if Adam and Eve, the story of creation, is correct, either there was incest or there were a lot of ribs floating around someplace. And to the next step, if I recall correctly, genetically, that Cleopatra was not only married to her brother, two brothers, as a matter of fact, was the product of six generations of brother-sister relationships and was listed as one of the most beautiful and talented women in the world. Beyond that, of course, the kings and queens of Hawaii were married to each other, again, for generations they kind of lost track on, and they seem to be genetically sound. So there is a greater genetic problem with certain other aspects of human relationships than that one. Why does the government suddenly get involved in this one?
Well, I think as you say, putting the moral taboos aside, there is scientific proof. Mr. Muth's own expert at the trial court level.
So the possibilities are greater.
The possibilities are 12 to 25% greater, at the very least.
And but that can be said of a number of other marriages in which people are permitted to not only procreate, but to go on happily cohabiting and producing that sort of thing. Even all the statistical odds with that particular relationship may show 50 or 100% possibility of genetic defects. So why does the state suddenly take an interest in this one?
Well,
other than a moral issue.
Well, I think I don't know that it's reasonable to say that just because the state hasn't included every possible risk of genetic defect in its criminal statutes that therefore it can't outlaw any of them.
I agree, but I want to know what makes this one so particularly obnoxious to the
legislature. Well, I think it's because it's not just genetic defects. I think you do get into other interests like family harmony, where you don't know, where your father is also your uncle, and your cousin is also your sister, and that you do have.
We're trying to the duty of the legislature is to make sure that there are harmonious relationships and people know who their cousins and uncles are.
I think it's a rational basis. I think it
who
is.
Who you know?
Well, it can be along with other. It's interesting. Mr. Hildebrandt argues that this law, as applied to him, is unconstitutional.
It was client.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought I said Mr. Muth, but maybe I didn't. I meant to say Mr. Muth said that as applied to him, this law is unconstitutional. This family is a prime example of why there is a rational basis for this law, and you find if you read the L&M decision upon which the Court of Appeals rested its decision, you'll see the discussion of Wisconsin Court of Appeals, who then quoted the trial judge, the tenacity of dysfunction between these two because they continued to engage in an incestuous relationship that continued to produce children despite repeated efforts to stop it. And as a result, we had children that were dysfunctional in and of themselves, who were abandoned, who suffered greatly in the presence of their parents and improved dramatically when they were taken away from their parents. And so when we're looking at rational bases for this law, for incest statutes, and especially as applied to consenting adults, we take into account all of these factors: the genetic issues, the family harmony, the family hierarchy, the well-being, you know. And then there's a coercive aspect involved here, where you have, whether it's a brother or sister or father-daughter incestuous relationship, I think there are legitimate concerns about, is this really a mutual...
Well, they were consenting adults. I think that was conceded.
The 944-06 doesn't...
There was some indication in the record that they were reluctantly involved in this?
I don't think it was established one way or the other. There was a 15-year age difference here.
Yeah, but they were both adults.
And consent is not an element of 944.
Are we going to separate... Do we conclude that everybody who's has a spouse that's 15 years younger is coercing the spouse into the marriage and the relationship?
No, but if it's a brother that you grew up with since birth...
She didn't grow up with him since birth. Well, they were separated all along.
Right, but if you... She learned that it was her brother.
Yes.
When, long before they started bearing children.
Right.
And I think
and by
at that
time
point,
she was an adult. She was an adult. She made up her own mind. She was not coerced. As far as I know, the record is deadly silence on the idea. Matter of fact, it indicated consenting adults. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here at all. If we were a matter of overpowering her will one way or another, we wouldn't be here. There'd be a different charge.
Well, I don't think you can ignore the potential for psychological harm in any sort of incestuous relationship. I mean, I think that
is
it would
that
be...
It's the psychological harm that's the predicate, and against whom does the psychological harm... Who's harmed?
Well, I think it
in the relationship.
In this situation, since we're talking about as applied, I think it's more like...
Other than the neighbors being outraged over this whole crazy thing, who was harmed?
Well, I think you can argue, judging... again, going back to the Allen M. Court of Appeals decision, I think there were questions about their own, the two of their own stability, but also the children. The four children born of this union were harmed.
Was that proved in this case?
In the civil case, Allen M.
Well, the old adage that a tie is like kissing your sister would be harmed here, wouldn't it?
Well, and 944-06 does not outlaw kissing your sister. It outlaws sexual intercourse, which is another... When we're talking about a narrowly tailored law, this specifically does not talk about sexual contact. It talks about intercourse, which, of course, is the most likely... The only way you can lead to procreation... Well, I shouldn't say only, but it's certainly the most likely way, and I, because of the concerns about the potential for bearing children that may be less able, less genetically equipped to function in this world, and may have parents who are not as equipped to raise them in a proper fashion. And I think that these are... talking about a non-fundamental right, and I insist that there's not a fundamental right for anyone to engage in incest, that amounts to a rational basis. But if this court wants to apply Lawrence v. Texas and extend it, I think, is way beyond its bounds, I believe that these rise to the level of compelling interests that the state can take into account. But I do want to make one point about Lawrence.
One thing, are you still there? How long has this law been in existence? Do you know?
I believe there's been a form of it since statehood. Now,
and
I could be wrong
on
that.
Do you know what the statistics are in other states? How many other states have this law in place or similar?
My understanding is that virtually every state has one. Whether it's all 50, I can't say for sure. I believe all 50 do, and I have not found a case that holds.
It's all 50, but you're not sure they all enforce the law.
No, I'm not sure how often it's enforced.
Well, certainly when you apply for a marriage license, it is, isn't
well,
it?
Well, and that's, yeah. And, of course, this came to light when one of the children of the Muths was abandoned at a babysitter's house and became sick, and there was no one to care for her. And then they did some blood tests, and it became clear that these two were the parents, and that's when the investigation started. One of the points in Lawrence v. Texas was that the sodomy laws were not being enforced. I see my light is on.
No, so. You got 5 minutes.
Oh, I still have. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think what an important distinction to be made with Lawrence, and I think if you look at it closely, and if you especially look at Justice O'Connor's concurrence, the main thrust of Lawrence was not that sodomy laws in general are bad. It was more to the point that sodomy laws were being used to discriminate against a class of persons. And both the majority and Justice O'Connor point out that sodomy laws were in existence pretty much since the beginning of this country, but they generally were directed at non-procreative sexual conduct. And then all of a sudden, starting in the 1970s, they were directed at one particular class of persons, and that was homosexuals. And that the court found to be repugnant. And again, Justice O'Connor goes on at length discussing this. And coupled with that, these laws were rarely enforced. And so they were being used basically to harass a class of persons. We don't have that component here. This, in fact, it's interesting. The majority in Lawrence said Bowers v. Hardwick was wrong to just focus on the act, the sexual act itself between the two consenting males in that case, that we look beyond it, and you cannot take the act out of the context of the relationship. And if you look at the relationship, then you're talking about a law used to discriminate against a class of persons. Well, here, Mr. Muth wants us to do the opposite. He wants us basically analyze the way Bowers v. Hardwick did. Just look at the act itself. These are two adults having an act of sex. That's okay. Don't look at anything beyond it. No, Lawrence says, no, you do look beyond. You look at the act and the implications of it and who is protected, who is harmed, all of that. And we do not have a suspect class here. We have any, you know, incest is engaged in by all types of people, male, female, young, old, gay, heterosexual, whatever. The fact is that if you look beyond this act and you see the social ramifications that have been recognized throughout the years, again, taking aside from the morality component, you see that there are state interests that need to be protected here, or at least it's reasonable for a legislature to say that we're going to step in and at least prevent intercourse. Again, not just general contact, but intercourse, which may very well lead to childbearing and may create other social problems, other ills, burdens on society, all of those things that really developed in this case. You know, again, as you look at the L&M case, and that gets back to the point at the top I made about, is it worse to go to jail or lose your children? And Mr. Hildebrand argues that the Court of Appeals didn't reach the merits because, in essence, it applied by analogy its decision in L&M. Well, I think the L&M decision, if the Court of Appeals in this case was, in essence, saying if it's okay for the state to take children away under the Due Process Clause and as well under the Equal Protection Clause in that case because of an incestuous parenthood, then it's okay for the state to punish someone for engaging in incestuous sexual intercourse because it could lead to incestuous parenthood. I think that's a reasonable reading of the law. I think that's a reasonable application of constitutional principles that were in existence, especially at the time of that decision, which was years before Lawrence v. Texas was decided. But I think it's a correct reading of the U.S. Constitution, even in light of Lawrence v. Texas. And my light has gone on, so I'll conclude. Thank you. Okay, unless there are further questions.
Fine. Thank you. Mr. Hildebrand?
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, I'd like to say that the record in this case is in the criminal case is very brief. The sexual activity was proven by the fact that they had children. A very short trial. That was the only evidence that was really put in. There's absolutely nothing in the record or otherwise to indicate that this was anything other than a fully consensual, freely consensual relationship. I just want to make that clear. Now, the record in the Allen M. case, which I put in the appendix, which the Court of Appeals rested its decision on, goes into what circumstances are there for to take away children from their parents, and that is determined upon the best interest of the child as made clear under Wisconsin law in some cases that have been recently decided, which are in our briefs. But I would like to go back to something that my opponent said and revisit the Lawrence case. The Lawrence case is not directed to homosexuality because, and I would just quote from that opinion, the statutes do seek to control a personal relationship that, whether or not entitled to formal recognition in law, is within the liberty of persons to choose without being punished as criminals. And then it suffices for us to acknowledge that adults may choose to enter upon this relationship in the confines of their homes and their own private lives and still retain dignity as free persons. This decision is very broad, and it says what you do in private in your own home with consenting adults, the state has no business intruding into the bedroom. And that's the basis of this decision. And as difficult and unpleasant it is may be to have to apply it, I think that that's what our Supreme Court has decided. And I think a careful reading of Lawrence will show that it is not restricted to just two men. I think that my client is entitled to be released from the burdens of his criminal conviction, and that's what we ask the court to do. I thank your honors very much for listening to my argument. I really appreciate it. If there are any questions, I am finished.
Well, among other things, I think we ought to thank you for accepting the appointment.
Thank you, your honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement, and we'll move.